Audi.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. Adventurer and ultra-runner Jamie Madison has run hundreds of miles through vast deserts, lived with a nomad in Central Asia, raced on horseback with a crazy herder on the remote old postal roads in Kazakhstan, pulled a camel through 100 miles of desert in Uzbekistan, and lived with eagle hunters in Mongolia. With fascinating stories about how expeditions can challenge and change you and have a surprising mental and physical lasting effect, it's Jamie Madison on the Big Travel Podcast. You came to my attention because you have a lovely little film entered into the Four Seasons Film Festival. Tell us a little bit about that.
The film is called All That's There, and it documents a 70-mile ultramarathon that I did across the Sariasik Atharau Desert in Central Asia, in Kazakhstan, which is probably the first crossing of that desert on foot. And it will be screening at the Four Seasons Film Festival at the BFI Film Forever, Wednesday, 20th of March, so not too far away.
It's the world premiere, I hear.
Yes, it is. No one else has seen it yet.
Oh, that sounds brilliant. And, oh God, where should we start then? Should we start with that journey? Should we start with how you got into exploring in the first place? Where would you like to start?
Let's start with how I got into exploring in the first place. It's a story that spans the entirety of my life, as it were. I grew up reading lots of mountaineering literature. My dad was is still a very keen hill walker, and I grew up reading about Joe Tasker, Pete Boardman, Joe Simpson, all this sort of Chris Boddington, all these famous mountaineers who had done some really impressive ascents. And I thought, oh, that's what I want to be. That's what I want to do. And I went to university. I immediately joined the mountaineering club. I was climbing all the time. I hardly studied because I just spent all the time going up into the hills in the Brecon Beacons and going to the crags and whatnot. And even when people couldn't come with me, I was still going off by myself, scouting new routes, trying to climb the cleaning them up, all this sort of stuff. So my background was very much rock climbing. And as soon as I finished university, I got a stringer role. So a few articles here and there for a rock climbing magazine, and also helped do some of their stuff on their website. I really loved that. And I started to get this passion to, right now, I'm going to start doing the big expeditions. And my friend, a longtime friend called Matthew Traver, who actually made the film All That's There, invited me on an expedition to Kyrgyzstan in 2010. And I went along and it was amazing. I was recording and writing it all up for my publication, for Climber magazine. And I just fell in love with Kyrgyzstan and Central Asia, and it was so interesting. They'd just gone through a revolution. There'd been lots of dicey stuff going down in the city of Osh in the south, and it felt like a place that tourism didn't quite exist yet. And it just seems so interesting because my other passion is sort of Russian Soviet history, so that was always an area I wanted to explore anyway. Long story short, I decided that actually what I want to do is come back to this region and I want to do a big expedition there. And that sparked off the journey of doing expeditions in Central Asia. And I've done about 9 different little trips, some small, some quite large, across the various countries that make up Central Asia.
Now, this is interesting because you're living this sort of dual life. You work in the city, in marketing, in finance, and you're sitting here very smart. You know, you're going back to your city job and everything. How have you managed to balance those two worlds? They must be very different.
Yeah, they are quite different. It's really interesting. To begin with, when I was younger, I did quite large expeditions. Myself and Matt Traver spent 6 months going around Central Asia. We spent 2 months on horseback, a month and a half living with a nomad, like a herder in Tajikistan, did some sort of smaller runs across the desert in Uzbekistan. Very long, expansive trips, which were very, very difficult mentally to come back from. It was quite a lot of work once you were actually back. So by the time you'd sort of recovered from that, it was like 8 or 9 months. Circumstance brought me to London and set me on a path. I felt like I couldn't really be taking 9 months out at a time at any point as I grew older. So I looked for a format that would satisfy my need for adventure and expedition and doing things that I thought no one had potentially done before with
earning a few quid.
Yeah.
It's that age old problem of funding.
Yeah, I was tired wearing t-shirts that I'd owned for 8 years or so. And I didn't want to be just so stoic and not have anything. I wanted to actually have a little bit of enjoyment in my life, which is one of the difficulties when you get into adventure full time and you start really, really wanting to do expeditions and trips. You become quite, what's the word, masochistic? Like you kind of forget about the joys and pleasure of life, except for when you're on a trip. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to balance that more. I wanted to have a little bit more, just relax a little bit more. So I looked for a format of adventure that I could do, be really intense, still satisfy that need to explore and see the remote regions of the world with actually being, inverted commas, normal person. And that's when I hit upon ultra running as an idea. You can cross quite large expanses of territory that people may have never gone through or very infrequently gone through, do it within a week, and then be back at your desk for Monday morning.
What is ultra running? Is it just a very, very long run?
I mean, there are ultra marathoners and ultra runners and who do it much better than I do and are purists, and I'm sure that they might disagree with me. But yeah, in essence, I feel like it's running for a long time. Technically, I think anything that's over a marathon, even if you did half a mile over a marathon, would be a ultra run. But some people go for hundreds and hundreds of miles.
And how long do you go for?
The longest I've done in one continuous go is 70 miles, which is actually very modest for an ultra runner.
It sounds like a lot of running to me.
It sounds like it was. I was quite slow. It was across sort of deserty conditions. There was lots of ups and downs of sand dunes. This was in my latest Sarasek Atharau desert crossing, and it took me quite a long time. By the time I'd done it, it was like 30 hours. Great people can do 100 miles in under 24 hours.
Let's look at that in more detail, though. So you're running through sand. That's pretty hard. What is it like? You know, what are you seeing?
There's two main expeditions that I've done where I've done ultra marathon running. The one that we've been talking about is the Sarasek Ultra, but before that I did 8 marathons in 8 days across a place called the Betpak Dala. And the Betpak Dala is even more remote than Sarasek Atharau. It's very remote. People don't want to go in there.
Where is it?
It's in Kazakhstan. Both of these are in Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan is the size of Western Europe, and it's got 3 or 4 sizable deserts that people have never heard of before. The Betpak Dala means the unlucky steppe, or the unlucky desert, or the desert of misfortune.
And it's a great start.
Yeah, I know. It's about the size of Scotland. And what you see on that is exactly the same thing that you see. You'll see everything in the first 5 miles that you'll see for the rest 250 miles. It was like one of those Roadrunner cartoons where the background just cycles around again. Or the other way I compared it to was like, it's almost like a chessboard or something. A painting, that was what I compared it to. You set off and you start at the beginning of the painting and the perspective is all skewy and you finally get to the horizon 2 hours later that you saw, and you get there, you look over the little ridge and it's exactly the same thing as where you've come from. And you do that on and on and on and on again until you get to the other side.
Is it desert? Is it dunes?
The Betpak Dala was more scrubland. It wasn't quite duney. The Sarasek Atharau desert has dunes at the start and the end, closer to the rivers, and then in the middle it's kind of this endless flat.
Mentally, what does that take to keep you going if there's not even like a different view around the corner to entertain you?
I found it incredibly hard mentally. It was to run those distances in that terrain. To cope with that sort of distance and to cope with that sort of lack of stimulation, it was all about the watch. It was all about, okay, I would break it down into 4-hour segments, which are then, so you have a 4-hour block and broken down into hour blocks within that. Every hour you could stop and have a refill. You would have refills and water refills on the way, but those are the the hour was like your 10-minute break, and then the 4 hour was like your half an hour break. And so you would just focus on the watch, focus on the timing until you got to that point that you'd have a break, and then you'd reset, and then you'd redo it. And you would have that, by having that regimented approach to time, you didn't have to worry about the next 6 days, you just had to worry about the next hour. Or the next 40 minutes until it got to the hour point.
Physically, that must really take it out for you as well.
Yeah, physically, those sort of journeys really did exhaust me. I haven't run since the Saratek Atarau, which was like a year and a half ago.
You mean not even for a bus or anything?
No, maybe for a bus. I think the most I've managed is about 2 miles around a track or something. I've just kind of like, it just was so exhausting for me. It was not... I have a very full-on job. You know, I'm also married. I don't have bags and bags of time to train to the sufficient level that I perhaps should have. So it was a lot of kind of gritting through it. And afterwards, you feel exhausted when you first finish. But afterwards, it's so much harder. You just feel... I felt low for like months afterwards, not wanting to do any exercise. Really draining.
For months? Wow.
Yeah.
A significant effect.
Yeah. It's...
What was it like when you crossed the finishing line? How did that feel?
It's great, because when you're crossing these sort of deserts, they're usually framed by two rivers, one at the start and one at the end, and then in the middle is the empty expanse. So with the Saratek Atarau Desert that's shown in the film All That's There, you finish on a river and you're aching. I can barely move at this point. I'm doing like 16 minute miles, which are like really, really slow. You know, people can do that so easily. And every single bit of me is aching, but you kind of run down this little hill and then there's this river air and it spurs you on. And you go down there, and I ran in and I just sat down in the water and like, and I'm just like, oh. It was a really good feeling. But it can also be a bit anticlimactic. You spend all your time imagining what the end goal will be, and then you get there and it's, you know, it's just a river. It's just a bit of territory that looks like any other bit of territory. So you kind of feel like, oh, was that it? Was that what I did? You know, that was a lot of work for something. You've kind of conquered an idea of something, perhaps in your own mind. You may have like accomplished a concept that you put out to achieve, but when you get to the end, you realize that it's just something that you've put forward, and really the conquest or the idea or the success comes from how you recognize and appreciate that what you've just done. Because you can very easily, and when a lot of my earlier expeditions, I would do a trip and I would do something and I would set out to do it. And I'd get to the end and then I'd be very hard on myself and I'd be like, oh yeah, but I didn't do this. This didn't happen. I think we cheated there because, you know, I hopped in the car for 2 minutes or something, like, or whatever the expedition was, like, oh, this is the reasons why it wasn't actually as pure as I thought it would be. And as I grew older and I started to do this more, I recognised that setting these rules, it only matters to you. It's never going to matter. The trip is never going to matter as much to anybody else as it does to you. So how you look at it and how you look on your achievements is really defines how they should be perceived and how what you think about it. And if you go through all that and you don't enjoy it and you don't think you've done it well, then what was it all for? So I've learned as I got a bit older to sort of enjoy the experience
enjoy the journey.
Enjoy the journey, even if the journey is quite painful.
It sounds very painful. You mentioned spending 2 months on horseback crossing. Where were you crossing?
Again, that was Kazakhstan. I've done quite a few trips
in Kazakhstan.
Yeah, Kazakhstan.
I've never been, so tell me about it.
Kazakhstan is a beautiful place. I've been back 3 or 4 times now. You have the deserts in the west. You have, again, out in the west, you have these like sort of almost like Nevada territory or Utah, wherever the big monument valley is. And then to the north, you have kind of Greenland and steppe. And again, the east as well, you've got steppe. When I did my first expedition in 2010 to Kyrgyzstan, I read a book called The Mountains of Heaven, which talked about this Tian Shan Mountains, which are on the sort of southeasterly edge of Kazakhstan. And an old British Anglo-Irish explorer, actually, called Sir Charles Howard Berry, had in 1913 ridden across that territory down the old postal roads to get and see the area and to go, I think it was to go hunting in the mountains. And it just seemed like a kind of quirky British adventure. I kind of liked the idea of it. So myself and my friend Matthew Traver made this plan that in 2013, 100 years to the day, we would go down the same post roads on horseback and see how the territory had changed in the 100 years since. We both didn't know how to ride horses when we set that plan out. And we spent a bit of time learning, but really, in essence, we just turned up to the north of Kazakhstan in sort of May, June time, 2013, went round a few farms, bought 3 horses and pointed them south and rode them south for 67 days or so, the whole expedition was, before we got to the outskirts of Almaty, which is Kazakhstan's sort of second capital.
Wow, that's incredible. Where were you sleeping? Were you camping or...?
Yeah, we were camping. We were camping in tents. Well, we were camping in one quite open tent. It was like almost like a teepee, and we hadn't brought any bug spray with us, and we didn't quite realise just how buggy it would be. So we spent 2 months getting bitten and fighting off sort of like ticks and stuff. So it was quite uncomfortable one as well.
Sounds like an incredible adventure. What was the most standout occasion on that trip?
The most standout occasion on that horse riding trip was definitely, it came about a third of the way through, and a Kazakh herdsman approached us and offered us a place to sleep for the night. We were kind of in a quite remote territory and there wasn't much around. And as part of that, he asked us to go see his herd and help him like herd it to the next area or make sure they're all there and count it. Oh, it was a herd of cows. But as part of that, he was a bit of a gung-ho sort of character, and he decided to give us a race. And I was on a horse that we'd called Totoro, after the sort of Studio Ghibli character. And Totoro did not like to be beaten at anything. So as soon as he saw the other horse gallop, he galloped so fast. And it's about 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening. We're galloping into the setting sun. You've got this verdant grassland underneath with like flowers that, and it's, you're going so fast that the flowers are almost like streaks of like color. And I'm racing this traditional herdsman. And in the end, the horse was so fast, it beat him. So I left him behind, and he's still going. It's just me and the horse, and
you can stop now.
Yeah, you can stop. Don't throw me off. Do not hit a curve. You know, like the ground's not very even. He could have just like hit a trough, and we would have both been off, and then it would have been very serious because we're in the middle of nowhere. So it was that danger, the beauty, and the excitement all at the same time, with a bit of like a splash of competition. That was like the most standout moment.
Did you ever feel in danger? Apart from at that moment, it's quite dangerous.
Yeah, there was quite a few times that we felt in danger. There was situations where we accidentally stayed in a brothel and nearly got beat up. Like, oh, why are these rooms rented for an hour and then they're not again?
Why are these ladies being so nice?
Yeah, and basically, it was very, very stupid. There were times, a lot of times where we felt like the sort of galloping and could fall off there. There were some lightning storms that came right on top of us. That was in, like, the thunder sort of sucks the air from your lungs. Mostly, it was like an underlying sense of worry, because we're going through slightly remote areas, we can't carry that much equipment, and so we often didn't have that much food, and so you felt it was just this underlying tension that built and built and built for days at a time and weeks at a time, where you didn't have that much food. You have the stress of like managing horses for that period is very, very stressful.
Especially when you're not used to managing horses. I mean, you obviously must have got used to it pretty quickly, but...
Yeah. Yeah, you get used to managing horses, but we didn't have support on that expedition. The running expeditions, I would have a support vehicle with me, but with the horseback one, we had no support. So what that meant was we would wake up and we would spend maybe three and a half hours just getting the animals ready to ride for the day. By the time we'd left camp, we would ride for maybe 7 hours in 40 degree heat in the hot sun, worrying about where the next water point would be, not carrying that much food, so you're hungry. And then you might have sort of interactions with locals, and some people who might want to just cause a bit of mischief or just be a nuisance. And then in the heat, add that on, and then you finally get to camp, and then you've got to spend 2 hours setting up camp again, only to repeat it all the next morning. Day in, day out, it became very hard, very, very hard. You kind of just shut off from the world and just focus on what you need to do. And then unpicking that afterwards, once I'd got back, and trying to sort of come back to normal and be a sort of social creature in amongst other people was actually one of the hardest things I've done. It really changed me. It took a long time to unpick.
Did you anticipate it would change you as a person that much?
No, I didn't. I didn't at the time. I was very much focused. At the time, I was like, I'm going to be a professional explorer. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to make my living out of this. This is a stepping stone to going to Antarctica or going anywhere and doing big trips. I didn't really anticipate the effect it would have on me. And I didn't recognise it at the time, even when I got back. It's only in retrospect, with, you know, the hindsight of about 7 or 8 years looking back, and a lot of sort of self-work to figure out, actually, there was a lot of these sort of trips for me do shut you off. And coming back from that was very interesting process and took a lot of sort of self-work. So the sort of the after effects of the expedition are almost as hard as the expedition itself.
It's very interesting. I had Leveson Wood on recently and we spoke about how he finds it very hard to, you know, he said it's his explorations have paid some very good relationships. And luckily you're married, but he hasn't managed to sort of meet someone and stay with them because he's always off doing other things. But I didn't actually think about how the trips would change him and how resilient and how self-absorbed, I guess, you need to become when you're just you or two of you in a very remote area with nothing but yourselves to rely on.
Yeah, and it's, you have two aspects to your personality that I think change. The first is your reliance on other people in terms of your physical self-reliance, and you don't want to ask people for help, and you don't want to, you know, you don't feel like in work situations that you can be like, hey, I just don't get this. Like you have to be an autonomous unit. And, you know, there are individualistic people in the world, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think the second, the sort of deeper level that it took you through was because you don't have any interaction. We have, myself and Matt were the only two people that we spoke to for 6 months, and we kind of retreated into our own worlds because we knew exactly what the other person was going to say. So you spent a long, long time just being by yourself. We actually, later on in the trip, we had to wait for our visa to come through for Uzbekistan. We were still 7 days out from when it was allowed. And we couldn't afford to stay for a hotel. So we just went by a remote river and just did nothing for 7 days. Like nothing. We didn't speak to each other. We just sort of sat by the river for 7 days and did absolutely nothing.
Do you have books or anything?
I had one book. You sort of eke it out, but you get bored of reading after a while. So you just kind of like throw some rocks at the river. You kind of wait for the next time to eat food. And then you just keep on sitting there. And yeah, it's only when you look back and you're like, oh my God, that was strange. And human beings are social creatures, and our grasp of reality is based on what other people confirm or not confirm. If you hear a noise and you look to see if other people react to that noise, because otherwise you might have just imagined it. When you start going onto these very, very isolated self things, your breakdown, you kind of have a fundamental loosening of the grip of reality back into your own head. And so you're just inhabiting the world that you make. And so when you try and reach out of that world, because it's not always a very happy place, it's very not a happy place, because you're just focused on your own insecurities and whatnot, you can't use other people as a means of sort of comfort. And that can become very lonely. So yeah, there is a fundamental thing, I think, for people who really push themselves to this area, that the reliance on other people and talking to other people and just sort of being part of society it takes rehabilitation, I think. Okay, I think it definitely does.
I mean, when does that happen these days, like, especially with modern technology, when everyone's got a phone in their hand? You know, when do you... You really don't sit by a river for 24 hours, let alone for 7 days, you know, with nothing to do apart from your own mind to drive you mad.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that maybe the closest, I wouldn't know, I've never been, and I couldn't presume to know, but maybe military service, that might be, and maybe that is, maybe I had a much lower version of what these guys and girls experience. I don't know. But yeah, it's different. Like, now I do mindfulness, I do like meditation, and I'm kind of more aware of the present moment. Back then I wasn't. It was more, you just chase the thoughts around your own head. Mm. And it's a different sort of isolating awareness that comes with those sort of trips.
So tell me about some of your other adventures then.
after the horse ride, the next sort of expedition we did was we went to the east of Tajikistan, which is called the Pamirs. There is a highway that runs through it that cyclists love. It's like one of the best places to go for cycling, or sort of best expedition places. We just went to the sort of southeast corner, found a nomad, say, hey, can we live with you? We'll pay you like $5 a day. Just show us your life. And that's what we did. Again, a lot of just sitting around, not doing very much, waiting for him to do something. We'll go cut the grass. We'll go look at things. He might go like show us what he's hunting. We might go see these ruins. And we just spent, yeah, like a month doing that. And Matt made a film called Portrait of a Uzbek, which premiered a few years ago, which got quite a good reception, actually. It was an interesting trip, that one. After that, I did a 100-mile, 7-day run through Uzbekistan. So it was like half marathon a day, which is not very much. But I'd come off the back of, or we'd both come off the back of 4 or 5 months of not eating properly. So, and we've
been. What do you mean, like just being unhealthy?
No, as in, because we did this all in one trip, right, you see. So we'd done the horse ride, then we went to this. And then we're like, well, we've done something in Kazakhstan. We did something in Kyrgyzstan previously. We've done something in Tajikistan now. So let's go do something in Uzbekistan. And, you know, just spend every last penny that we ever had in savings. So then we went and did this run. Or I did the run. Matt walked. We also had a camel. And we're trying to match the camel with the walking pace, with the running pace. It was just a nightmare. It was a small, slightly crazy trip. Or quite a crazy expedition to finish it off.
I don't know. I want to ask about the camel. I want to ask what the nomads thought when you turned up and said, could I live with you for a month? I mean, what did the nomad respond?
Yeah, the nomad, he was like, yeah, okay, come on in. Like, because he obviously, it's a way of getting income. They did think we were slightly strange, I have to say. It was hard to communicate with them as well. I know a bit of Russian. He knew a bit of Russian. Uzbek knew a bit of Russian. But he was a sort of wheeler-dealer chap. He'd always got a sort of scheme or plot on the go. So he was always taking us around people's houses, showing us off, kind of thing. He was a real cheeky sort of person as well. He took us to see some family or some friends up in a sort of remote valley in like a car. And then after we'd done the visit, he drove us back down, or his friend drove us back down rather, and he stopped by these signs that we'd missed on the way past. And he's like, hey, look at this, ha ha ha, radioactive zone, keep out. Because it used to be an old uranium mine from the Soviet Union. And now people just live there and they kind of ignore the signs. But he didn't think to tell us that until after he'd done it. It was that sort of like, ha ha, we've got you sort of thing. Isn't it funny? And we're like, yeah, maybe.
Do you ever keep in touch with him? Are there ways of keeping in touch with him?
Yeah, I mean, look, he tried to, yeah, he WhatsApped me like a couple of years ago. He got my phone. I'm not sure how he got my phone number, actually. Oh, I think he got it off Matt for some reason. But he was a bit naughty. He was trying to say about his daughter needed surgery or something, and could we help out? And we got a few people and a few friends in Kazakhstan who sort of, Kyrgyzstan. He was in Kyrgyzstan at the time. A few friends in Kyrgyzstan who sort of looked into it in a bit more detail, and he's like, nah, he's just, he's trying to get money. He's not, his daughter's not actually sick.
Fair enough, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, you kind of figure, do I need $100? Mm. No. But I was like, I can't really. I can't. If you ask me for $100 and you need $100, then that's something. But if you say that someone's sick to get that, that's when it's kind of crossing a line a little bit.
I'm always conflicted when I'm asked for money, when, you know, by beggars and street kids and, you know, when traveling in Southeast Asia or elsewhere, because you kind of want to help them, but then you're told not to because, you know, they'll expect it, or, and, you know, to give to a charity instead who's doing the work. But then people say things about charities that are, you know, sort of skimming far too much off the top for the, you know, it's always difficult to know what to do. So I often look for something like in Cambodia, you know, they've got like restaurants that have kitchens run by street kids that, you know, actually are on the ground doing that sort of work, and, you know, try and look for those sort of things rather than just, you know, sort of handing over money. But it is very conflicting, isn't it? Because we have so much compared to people who have so little.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, it's a sort of moral quandary of being human, that confronted with so much poverty and inequality in the world, what do you do? But if you reduce yourself down and give everything, last thing away, you haven't really even made a dent into the sort of poverty. So then you have to balance questions about moral duty with personal happiness. I don't have the answers to it. It's really difficult. Yeah, as with, I think, many travellers, when you're confronted with it in the flesh, it's very difficult to figure out what the best way forward is.
It is indeed. What other adventures do I need to ask you about?
We had quite a fun adventure that was a little bit more lighthearted, where we went to a place called Mangistau, again in Kazakhstan, this time in the very far west. And we set out to see as much of it as we could see within a week. And this is quite a remote area. Again, it's the area that I was saying looks a bit like Monument Valley. And we just drove for like, I think we covered like 1500 kilometers just driving around. Like, it's all like salt lakes and stuff as well. So, you know, like when they used to do those speed runs on like really flat salt lakes. So just driving around, like just seeing the entire thing as much as possible, sort of off-road, etc. That was really good fun. Several years earlier, myself and Matt Traver went to Mongolia, and we lived with eagle hunters for a month. So these are these sort of traditional hunters that have huge golden eagles, and then they use that to catch prey. And we did this sort of smaller horseback journey over the course of 2 weeks. This horseback journey along the sort of Chinese border, met all these people, saw them hunt, live with them again, see how they live with their lives. That was really, really interesting. There was an adventure within that was 4 days long, where we just sat on a bus for 4 days to get from Olgi is the town in the far west, to Ulaanbaatar, and it took 4 days to get in a bus.
Was it more exciting than sitting by the river for 7 days?
It was more painful, I'll tell you that. It was like cramped, not only stopping for toilet breaks for it was probably marginally more exciting than the other one. And we also, the other trip that we did in Mongolia was we pack rafted down a river. Pack raft is an inflatable raft that you can fold away into a backpack. It was on the onset of winter, so it was going down to about minus 20 at night, and we were in the river, and there was ice flow in there as well. And every time you lifted the paddle out of the water, the droplets would hit your suit and they would instantly freeze. So you kind of peppered. Wow, it was so cold. I couldn't feel my toes for about, I couldn't feel my big toe on my right foot for about 2 years afterwards.
Seriously? Yeah. Well, you were lucky you didn't lose it.
I don't think it was ever in any danger of frostbite, but I think it was just kind of a little bit of nerve damage from just constant immersion.
When you're sitting there on this floating raft and things are freezing all around you, do you ever wonder, like, why the hell am I doing this? Or do you know if you've got a mission?
I think what drove me when I was younger, it was a sort of need to live a not ordinary life, a need to be special, combined with a slightly nihilistic, well, it doesn't matter, nothing matters, let's just push my body and experience the most that I can possibly experience. I've worked on that attitude, because that doesn't make you happy. Even if you accomplish what you need to accomplish, you still feel, as I was saying before, you still don't feel like you really did it, and there are other things that you could have done better, and there are bigger places that you could have gone, and you're never really satisfied. So as I've grown into my expeditioning, I've realized the role that it plays in my life, and that is that I do like it because it does make me slightly different. It gives me stories to tell. It gives me access to really impressive places and experiences, and the experience of pushing yourself and feeling that fatigue and knowing that you can come through that gives you this sort of agency and control that you know that you have a control over your life. But I've learned to pair that with a more social world, where I can hold down a job and I can have a wife and I can have a nice life and, you know, hopefully have kids soon, and just have it in the place that it is. And so that means now that I do less trips. I hope to do one maybe next year.
What are you gonna do?
Sounds really boring, but Kazakhstan again, because
this river you want to go and stare at for a few days.
Just go sit down for a while, chill out.
Sounds quite relaxing.
Yeah, no, there's one last main desert called the Rin Desert. It's in the northwest of the territory. It's quite big, just for completion's sake, so I can tick off all the deserts. There's that in the Aral Sea is now a desert, so I guess I could do that as well. But
that's a bit disturbing. It was a sea and now it's a desert. Is that a recent thing?
Yeah, well, the Aral Sea is like one of the world's worst ecological disasters.
It was. I've heard about this. Yeah.
They diverted the rivers There's two, the Amu Daura and the Syria Daura, I think. I might be pronouncing that wrong. The Soviet Union misdirected the rivers to water the cotton crops in Uzbekistan, and then the river, then the sea collapsed. It's now quite a toxic sea.
There's photos, aren't there, of like sort of boats?
Yeah, the boats. Yeah, that's it. People do visit it nowadays. They go into it. The outskirts are definitely a tourist attraction. Attraction's too strong a word. Mm. It's places that people do frequent.
Yeah.
So, but there is a crossing that could be done of that as well in some form, but it's a little bit more. You kind of have to wear like a mask or something. I don't know.
How does your wife feel about this?
Oh, she would hate it.
Does she just want to, she's like, come on, can we not just go to like Greece and like...
Yeah, that is actually where we're going this summer.
Oh, well, there
my,
you go.
My wife loves... She's not like that at all. We're definitely a kind of about going to like nice bars and restaurants and sort of going to, you know, we went to the south of France for a holiday. That's the sort of places that we like. And coming to be like, well, actually, I quite like this too. You know, I don't mind these sort of things. I like experiencing some of the finer things, and I don't have to be, you know, not have, you know, not wash for 2 months or sort of living out in, you know, like a caravan or something. Like, however you want to live your life, you can live your life.
Definitely. And that's with travel as well, you know, there's no point being snobby about travel. I love going to like a cheesy bar on the Costa del Sol, you know, to going somewhere wild and fabulous. You can do all of it.
Yeah. There's no, there's many different ways that people kind of look down on different things. People look down on it for being like, yeah, you know, you've gone to Ibiza or something. And people in Ibiza can look down and go, well, why would you go to some grotty outback? Like, everybody does that, or everybody has a different way of what they enjoy. And I think that's what's really great about adventure travel, is that people do really enjoy things and they really get a lot of sort of satisfaction from it. Mm. It's just when it's just the sort of, I guess, the moderation. Too much of anything can make you a bit squiffy. So
absolutely. It sounds like you've managed to get that balance where, you know, the one that Leveson Wood was actually, you know, we had a bit of a laugh about him looking for a wife, but the one that he was looking for, you know, is to get that balance between adventure and having a life for yourself and not being that isolated person sitting by that river, but be able to do that and be able to take part in normal life as well.
Yeah, and so the compromise that I've made on that is that my expeditiony trips are now, I wouldn't go away for more than 2 weeks. So I have to think of a format that would work to get to somewhere remote so that you can experience something unique and enjoy it and really get to grips with it, but in a shorter format, which is where the running came from.
What about somewhere like some of the most remote parts of the States? There's a lot to explore there, and North America and South America. Do you feel like branching out from Kazakhstan in that area of the world?
My wife's Brazilian, so going to South America properly would be quite interesting. I never really had that much. I guess I was quite snobby that I was like, I'm the Central Asia person, I'm going to focus on Central Asia. And there's still a few places that I really want to go to. Like Turkmenistan, for instance, I've not been to yet. Alaska, I would love to go down. I'd love to do those sort of river rafting trips and just float down remote territories and go to that sort of endless woodland. Beautiful places, and there's so many places. I mean, you just throw a pin at the map and anywhere has got something great to it. It's just figuring out what order you want to do them in.
Absolutely. Well, my last question is always about music, because I always think that music and travel go hand in hand. And I don't know if you have a chance to listen to music when you're doing your runs or any of your adventures, but if you had to choose one song that reminded you of a special, memorable time or place of travel, what would that song be?
Oh, that's a very good question.
I know, I like it.
That's well done. I don't listen to music when I'm running. I would say, to really sort of sum up the essence of how I was feeling on those runs at that time, or those sort of expeditions, I would say Run by Daughter, which is a little bit bleak, but it's quite a beautiful song. And I still, when I'm like, right, I have to do something, I'm in the mood. I've got a work deadline, I'm going to crush this, I'm unstoppable. You know, nothing can stop me except for myself. That's the song that I put on to play and listen to. Reminds me of the sort of control that we all have as human beings over our actions, and also the responsibility that comes with it.
And Jamie stars in the short film All That's There, which is showing at the Four Seasons Film Festival in London. Go to fourseasonsfilmfestival.com for more information.